This is AM. I'm Michael Brissenden. Divisions in the monarchist movement are this morning threatening to boil over with a call for new leadership from within one of the country's best-known anti-republican organisations. The call comes amid an increasingly bitter battle between rival monarchist groups over how to counter a new push for an Australian republic. Political reporter Tom Eagledon has more from Canberra.
Australians for a constitutional monarchy once dominated the anti-republican movement, but recently its rival, the Australian Monarchist League, has been getting all the media attention, especially its 21-year-old spokeswoman, Gabrielle Hendry.
We do a lot of media training for our young people so that they can go out there, reach out, tell people about the debate. We also have different activities, so events, we do some toasts, movie nights, sort of really fun things.
Defence commentator Neil James is on the ACT Council of Australians for a Constitutional Monarchy. He accuses the Monarchist League of being royalists, more interested in the celebrity surrounding the crown than its place in the Constitution.
And it's more than suspicious that the media continue now to go to the Monarchist League rather than reasoned constitutional monarchists who can offer a sound answer to Republican proselytising.
As monarchists bicker, Republicans are united behind the Australian Republican movement led by Peter Fitzsimons.
The Republicans do have the advantage of a bombastic national spokesman.
Long gone are the days, says Neil James, when monarchists too had effective advocates like Kerry Jones, who was instrumental in defeating a republic in the 1999 referendum. Is there anyone you see of that ilk at the moment that people can really rally behind and is an effective communicator in the media?
Look, I don't think there is at the moment, and that's part of the problem.
How can that problem be solved?
Well, I think that constitutional monarchists in this country are going to have to wake up a bit.
He's now openly questioning the leadership of ACM's long-serving national convener, David Flint.
Part of the problem is that Professor Flint is closely identified with one side of politics.
Has there been moves inside Australians for a Constitutional Monarchy for change at the top? Professor Flint has been there for a long time.
Look, not that I'm aware of, but I think it's something that ACM will have to address and address reasonably quickly, or else we'll continue to be on the back foot.
What Australians for Constitutional Monarchy do is really their concern.
Could you see any advantage in perhaps uniting under a single banner with a single spokesman?
Oh, that would really come down to the national chairs of both organisations to decide. So whether they find common ground and resolve differences, that would be great. Until then, I'm going to function as best as I can.
The Australian Monarchist League's spokesman Gabrielle Hendry, ending Tom Eagledon's report. Clive Palmer has rubbished claims he's been using an alias to operate as shadow director of Queensland Nickel. The billionaire MP has warded off accusations he's been secretly running North Queensland troubled nickel refinery, maintaining that he retired from the company in 2013 when he entered the political arena. But Mr. Palmer admits he remained part of an expenditure committee and signed off on company purchases using an email under the name Terry Smith. If the company is found to have traded while insolvent with Mr. Palmer as a shadow director, he could be held personally liable and face a hefty compensation payout. Courtney Wilson reports.
Clive Palmer has denied suggestions he used the alias Terry Smith to continue covertly running his North Queensland nickel refinery.
As I go across the country, you know, all over Australia, I use a whole lot of different emails from a whole lot of different people. That was somebody's email that I would have used that day to approve something.
Mr. Palmer says he retired from his business operations more than 3 years ago, but he admits he remained part of the nickel refinery's expenditure committee and had the power to sign off on purchases.
I was the CEO there for 4 years and I've got that personal experience, and I agreed to stay on that committee with six other people, and they have an approval. It's not just me that approves things, it's the committee, and that's all it is.
According to corporate law professor Ian Ramsey of Melbourne University, it is possible for directors' duties to be imposed on people who aren't properly appointed as a director.
If they are found by a court to be either a de facto director or shadow director and also found to have breached their duties, that person can be personally liable and possibly be held to pay compensation.
What could be the implications if Clive Palmer is found to have been operating in the capacity of a director of Queensland Nickel?
the consequences can be significant. In particular, important director's duties apply to that person, and if a court finds that one or more of those duties are breached, then personal liability can be imposed.
Professor Ramsey says director's duties include the duty to exercise reasonable care and diligence, to act in the best interest of the company, and not to have their company trade while it's insolvent. Clive Palmer says he's satisfied in how the business has been run and has again defended the $21 million Queensland Nickel has donated to the Palmer United Party since 2013.
There's been 2014 audited accounts, 2015 audited accounts, which show the company was completely solvent.
Since Queensland Nickel was placed into voluntary administration last week, there have been concerns about whether the company has the capacity to pay the $60 million it owes its creditors. Mr. Palmer says he hopes that the 237 refinery workers who lost their jobs are paid their entitlements, but says it's out of his hands.
I think they should get their entitlements. I've done all I can do in my family. I've put up $250 million of assets to support any arrangement that the administrator comes up with. But the administrator is the one that's in control.
Clive Palmer ending that report from Courtney Wilson. A federal opposition frontbencher says the Labor Party's national executive should bind all members to oppose an increase in the GST. The call from the South Australian MP Nick Champion is a direct challenge to the Labor Premier in his state, Jay Weatherill, who supports an increase in the consumption tax as a way to boost funding for health and education services. Nick Champion is speaking here to AM's Naomi Woodley.
This is a question of Labor values, and Labor's always been in favour of progressive taxation measures, and we've always opposed progressive taxation measures. We opposed the GST when it was first mooted in 1993 in the Fight Back package. We opposed John Howard's GST of 10%, which was supposed to never, ever be increased. We should oppose this Turnbull tax, this proposal to increase the GST from 10% to 15%, because it's profoundly regressive and profoundly unfair to working people, to people on fixed incomes, pensioners, and to the middle class. It sets up Australia to have an unfair economy and an unfair society.
And yet the Labor Premier in your state, South Australia, Jay Weatherill, says he's prepared to wear an increase in the GST if it leads to a solution to the health and education funding shortfall facing the states and territories. Why is he wrong?
Well, the states have been put in a very difficult position. They've had to suffer Tony Abbott's cuts of $60 billion to health and education, and now they're having to sort of countenance or consider the Turnbull tax, the increase of the GST from 10% to 15%. And it won't stop there. If the GST is raised in Australia, it will follow the direction of other consumption taxes around the world. The UK has currently got a consumption tax of 20%. Some of the Nordic countries have got up to 25%. So, you know, if the Liberal Party gets away with this this time, the GST will only be going one way and it will go beyond 15%.
And yet you want the National Executive to tell a member of your own party, Jay Weatherill, to say, you know, stop with the campaign that you're clearly on with other state premiers to allow the federal government to go down this route if it's a way to address health and education funding shortfalls?
Well, sometimes Labor Party policy has to be settled, and the National Executive and the National Conference are the right organs of the party to do it, the right decision-making bodies of the party to do it. And what I'm suggesting is we really need an iron discipline in the party to defeat what is a very, very regressive taxation measure.
Jay Weatherill says he'd be happy to consider an alternative if one was out there, but at this point there is nothing else that would replace the $80 billion of funding states and territories were expecting over 10 years for health and education. So aren't you boxing him into a corner that he needs to address as part of his job?
Well, there are other provisions on the table. The federal government could close the superannuation taxation loopholes tomorrow. The Labor Party federally has had a plan out there for, I think, about 6 months or so.
This kind of policy platform proposal, if I can put it that way, would normally be decided at a national conference, but how quickly would you like to see National Executive consider this matter and make a binding resolution? What's the mechanics of it?
Look, that's, I suppose, the National Executive to consider, and there'll obviously be internal matters to discuss about that. I guess I'm just putting it out there that I think the Labor Party should have a united front against Mr Turnbull's tax.
The Shadow Parliamentary Secretary for Manufacturing and Labor MP Nick Champion speaking to Naomi Woodley. Allegations a paedophile ring of Anglican clergy sexually abused boys in the 1980s will be put to the Royal Commission this week. Abuse survivors maintain some in the church hierarchy knew about the abuse. In its first hearings of the year, starting in Hobart today, the Commission is examining how the Anglican Diocese of Tasmania, Adelaide, Sydney and Brisbane and the Church of England Boys' School handled abuse allegations. Samantha Donovan reports.
Steve Fisher was 13 when Anglican priest Garth Hawkins started sexually abusing him in the early 1980s. The abuse went on for 3 years. Mr Fisher will tell the Royal Commission this week that his was not an isolated case.
A paedophile ring would be the only way to describe it. We know the main players that are involved, and that was a now deceased priest from South Australia. That was Lou Daniels from Tasmania and Garth Hawkins from Tasmania, plus another couple from Queensland and New South Wales. They ferried boys between camps, between the states, and we know from what we saw and the way it was set up, so the Church of England Boys Society was basically used to ferry boys for paedophiles to abuse.
Garth Hawkins was convicted and jailed for the abuse of 7 Tasmanian boys, including Steve Fisher, in 2003. Mr Fisher is adamant the Anglican Church hierarchy knew Hawkins was abusing children.
And he was moved from parish to parish because of the rumours that were circulating around the community about him having young boys stay with him all the time. So we want to know why they did nothing. And we'd like to know the extent to which the church hierarchy knew. We know what we saw as kids, but obviously there's a lot more to it than that, and we're hoping that this all comes out in the Royal Commission.
What makes you so sure that the Anglican Church did know about the activities of some of these priests?
Number one, Hawkins told me. And number two, there were church hierarchy at different parties and things that Hawkins and his cohorts tended to hold. So probably 15 years now we've been campaigning for this, and we really want to know the extent to which they did know.
The federal government is expected to announce any day now whether it'll support the Royal Commission's recommendation to set up a national compensation scheme for the victims of institutional child sexual abuse. Is it important to you that such a scheme is established?
I think a national scheme is the best idea. I mean, churches and so forth have offered victims virtually nothing. And to have a national scheme, it needs to be, you know, if you're abused and it's found out in a court of law, you get X amount of dollars. The way it's run at the moment, you're subjected to psychologist reports. You're basically re-traumatised when you are going through that process, and that's not good enough.
The Anglican Diocese of Tasmania says it fully supports the work of the Royal Commission.
Samantha Donovan. This is AM Around Australia, where it's 24 minutes past 7. You can also follow us on Twitter. Just search for the hashtag ABCAM. The ABC has learnt investigations into the Jakarta terrorist attack have been extended to Malaysia. The director of Malaysia's Special Police Branch has revealed to AM a telephone call was made by one of the Indonesian attackers to someone in Malaysia just prior to the attack. Security in Kuala Lumpur has been stepped up since the Jakarta blasts, and Malaysian authorities say they're doing all they can to stop an attack on home soil. Correspondent Samantha Hawley is in the Malaysian capital and filed this exclusive report.
Mohamed Fuzi is the director of the special branch of the Malaysian Royal Police. After questioning from the ABC, he's revealed investigations surrounding the Jakarta terrorist attack and now shifting to Malaysia.
What we know, they are in contact with each other. That is the only thing that we discovered at this moment.
What was their contact between these two groups in Malaysia and in Indonesia before the Jakarta attacks?
I can only reveal to you, after forensic investigation conducted by our Indonesian counterpart of Polri, there is one phone call made by the attacker to a Malaysian phone call. We are investigating, we are probing this at the moment.
So there could be some sort of link between
With that investigation is gearing to that.
He says of the more than 500 suspects with links to IS who've been arrested in Malaysia since 2013, 27 were foreigners, mainly Indonesian, who'd been deported home. The head of Malaysia's prison department, Jamaluddin bin Saad, says in prisons today there are 38 inmates jailed for supporting Islamic State. He says the most radical are kept away from other prisoners.
It is very important to separate this inmate between leaders and followers. And at the same time, it is very important to isolate the individual who are capable to influence the others.
In Indonesia, one of the attackers, Muhammad Afif, had been released from jail where he'd been serving time for terrorism offences just 6 months before he launched the attack. At a counter-terrorism conference in Kuala Lumpur, Sydney Jones from the Institute of Policy Analysis and Conflict explained why she thinks the Indonesian prison system is failing to keep radicalism under control.
We've had cases just about 3 months ago of a man who smuggled in his wife for 3 days, a convicted terrorist. Nobody reported it to the authorities until the third day. We've had visitors smuggled in from outside to stay overnight to conduct conversations, and we've had ISIS paraphernalia smuggled into prisons.
More than 500 Indonesians are thought to have travelled to Syria. Authorities say about 50 Malaysians are fighting there. This is Samantha Hawley in Kuala Lumpur reporting for AM.
It's been compared to Nazi-era policy, but that hasn't stopped the Danish parliament passing a bill that could see asylum seekers stripped of their assets. Under the new laws, asylum seekers could be forced to hand over any valuables worth more than $2,000. The United Nations Refugee Agency says the measures are wrong and dangerous. Europe correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
Of the million asylum seekers and migrants who've flooded into Europe over the past year, Denmark has taken in just 20,000. But the Danish government says that's more than enough. The parliament has approved measures allowing police to carry out searches of asylum seekers' belongings and confiscate assets worth more than $2,000. Items of sentimental value, such as wedding rings, are exempted. The new laws will also see those granted refugee status unable to apply for family members to join them for 3 years. William Spindler is a spokesman for the United Nations Refugee Agency.
It's wrong to take away from people who have lost already so much and suffered so much, the few belongings that they have managed to rescue, and also to discriminate against them by not allowing them to be reunited with their families.
The new laws, which passed with cross-party support, have been compared to the Nazi policy of taking gold and other valuables from Jews.
No, I think it's quite distinguished different. We are still protecting people coming here as refugees, not putting them into a gas chamber, just to take the obvious example. But what we're doing here is actually putting refugees on equal footing with Danes who want public welfare. The principle being that you have to pay yourself before you are getting assistance from the state.
Anders Vistisen is a member of the European Parliament for the Danish People's Party.
The Danish Parliament have seen a necessity to limit the influx of migrants coming to Denmark. It's putting quite a strain on the Danish welfare model.
But you have over 5 million people in Denmark. 20,000 is surely a tiny fraction of that. Can't you cope?
No, because we all also have, from the past, migrant and refugees flows, quite a big of a leftover of unintegrated third world inhabitants in Denmark.
Don't you think that means you have a problem with integration rather than with immigration?
It means that we get the wrong migrants, for sure. But our solution, first and foremost, would be to have an Australian model put in force in Europe, so we will not have spontaneous asylum seekers.
But how do you do that? How do you do that? Australia is surrounded by sea and Europe has open borders.
Most of the people coming to Europe are coming by sea. So you can say we have, in that sense, a similar situation, but we don't have the will.
If measures such as these aim to discourage asylum seekers entering Europe, they're having so far little effect. 45,000 migrants have crossed from Turkey into Greece this month, more than 30 times the number who made the same crossing last January. This is Barbara Miller reporting for AM.
To finance now, Wall Street is sharply higher. A short time ago, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 1.5%, helped by some strong corporate earnings. earnings. Stocks in Europe were also stronger. The Australian dollar is higher this morning at 70.1 US cents. And that's AM for today. I'm Michael Brissenden. It's 7:30.